This is the second in a series of four lectures on lessons from the design of everyday things. Next slide. So last time what we talked about were perceived affordances, visible constraints, causality, and mapping. And today we're going to talk about transfer effects, idioms and population stereotypes, and conceptual models. In fact, all we're going to do today is start on conceptual models. The next lecture is really going to dive deep into this concept and try to suss out some issues as they relate to conceptual models. and again, these are just essentially concepts and vocabulary that you can use when you're talking about problems and design that all designers actually understand and know well. Learning objectives for today, next slide, are that you should be able to distinguish between positive and negative transfer effects. You should be able to describe the role of interface idioms in regard to interface innovation. You should be able to discuss how cultural associations impact interface idiom design. You wanted to be able to identify components that contribute to conceptual models and to distinguish between conceptual models, conceptual design, and design system user model, and describe why these mismatches actually cause problems. Okay, so next slide. Transfer effects are essentially when people use their previous understanding of something and they try to apply it to the current situation. So a positive transfer effect happens when something that you learned in the past applies to the new situation, so it actually works out. A negative transfer situation is one where the something that you learned in the past actually conflicts with the new situation, and so actually applying what you knew before actually is going to cause problems. So if you hit the next slide, you can actually see that in real life, cars tend to be okay. They tend to promote positive transfer. That is, if I learn how to drive this beater, I will be okay once I make a lot of money and I can buy this like super expensive car, right? All the skills that I learned in one situation apply to the next situation. This doesn't always happen though. So if you take a peek at the next slide, here is one instance where it's actually completely broken, right? So this is the little wing handle on the left side, and for a buddy of mine who had a car that kind of was designed in this really funky way, it actually turned out that his wipers were controlled by the up-down situation on the left. And so when he moved to a new car where the left wing thing, I don't know what to call that thing, the left wing thing was actually used for handling the turning signal, then things got a little bit messed up. It actually took him a little while to kind of get out of the habit. So his old car was actually designed in kind of this weird, kind of non-standard, sort of funky way. If you think about driving in a car right now, typically these controls are fairly standardized. If you hit the next slide, this type of transfer effect happens in GUIs as well. So here's an example of essentially one of these audio racks. And in real life, here's an example of what it looks like. And on the right side, you have this application called Reason that is trying to mimic one of these audio racks. And you can see that lessons or the things that you know how to do in the previous situation apply to the situation that you've got here. And so here's some positive transfer. If you hit the next slide, here's another example of transfer effects. So basically, if you had grown up using ABI Word, which is a free, simple software editor, or a text editor, or a document editor, you should be able to kind of take that understanding and apply it to OpenOffice or Microsoft Word, right? All of these things would have nicely stacked up on top of each other, right? You understand what certain icons look like. You understand where certain menu bars tend to be or menus tend to be. This is positive transfer. Doesn't always work this way, though. So if you hit the next slide, Microsoft Word 2003 was sort of the last Microsoft Word that sort of had this toolbar kind of look. In the next version of Microsoft Word, they introduced the ribbon, and this actually messed everything up. And so you had some negative transfer here. People's expectations of where certain menu items should be were no longer there, and this was really, really problematic early on. One interesting that they did to facilitate a certain type of positive transfer was that at Microsoft, at least, what they did was for a while, and I think they still continue to do this, if you knew the old keyboard shortcut to do certain tasks, they still allowed those keyboard shortcuts to work in this new situation. So I thought that was kind of an interesting design choice that they made. And so the presumption there is that, you know, if you're a very effective Microsoft Word user, you're really familiar with the keyboard shortcuts, really makes you really quite efficient. Microsoft didn't want to make you a worse user of the system by introducing this ribbon. Next slide. So transfer effects apply across other applications as well, right? So knowing how to use Microsoft Paint helps you in certain ways to use Adobe's Photoshop. Obviously, these are kind of older images, but I think conceptually the idea is there, right? You have different toolbars, you have different tools. The tools and the icons tend to look fairly similar, and they use familiar graphics controls, familiar icons there to tell you what you can do, right? So next slide. So that's basically transfer effects, right? When people are able to transfer their learning and understanding of similar objects to current objects. This doesn't always work, but usually it does. Idioms and population stereotypes. So an interface idiom, this is something we just touched on a moment ago with respect to the Photoshop and Paint icons, right? Standard interface features that we've learned, that we use, and we're familiar with. And so this is typically what you want to do. Use familiar interface idioms. Idioms may actually define arbitrary behaviors, right? So for example, red means danger, green means safe. This is actually an arbitrary mapping. The great thing, though, is that if these mappings are something that we are familiar with, then we can actually use them in interface design, and it will be fine. When we vary from these, even if they're arbitrary, if we vary from these familiar idioms, then we're going to run into problems. So I've shown here an image of a warning sign where the warning is written in green, and it's kind of weird to look at, right? Something to note that is that, of course, population stereotypes, these things vary between cultures, right? So in the United States and in Canada, for a light switch, down is actually off, but in Britain, down is actually on. For faucets in Canada, turning it on is typically done one way, while doing it that way in Britain, it's actually turning it off. So these are some things to be to make note of and to understand when you're designing interfaces. So if you hit the next slide, so why does this become an issue? It becomes an issue when you change idioms or you ignore certain idioms as they come, right? So in the home, if you bring in a handyman and he's kind of taking care of the plugs for you, the light switches might actually be installed upside down. In my old home, for one reason or another, we had no idea why. When we moved in, it was the case that every single one of the power plugs was installed actually upside down. To this day, we still have no idea why it was the case, but it just was, right? And it was very strange. If you think about calculators and phone number pads, here you have two completely separate layouts. And as an exercise, I want you to think about which one did computer keypads follow, and why did that they make that choice? And then I want you to think about how it is that an ATM is actually laid out, and think about which choice they made there. If you take a peek at the next slide, this is really showing you that there's difficulty in changing stereotypes. QWERTY keyboard is the one that we're most familiar with. A Dvorak keyboard was introduced later, and it's actually probably faster to use. It turns out that people spend most of the time on the home row with the Dvorak keyboard, and that when you learn it, you're actually faster with it than typing with a QWERTY. But even though this is the case, the QWERTY is the one that we're most familiar with. It's the one that we see everywhere. And so as a consequence, changing it now is going to be very, very hard. What this tells you about is it tells you about interface design standards, right? So each platform that you're designing for, whether it be Windows or OS X or, you know, iPhone, you know, or an Android, each of these have sort of platform guidelines that you actually do want to stick to if you're deciding to explicitly go outside how that platform typically does things. Then you want to have a very good reason to do it, whether it's to draw specific attention to this feature, or for one reason or another. Either you think it's really awesome, or you think it's something that is going to have a catastrophic result, and you want to draw people's attention to it. That's when you That's when you deviate from common idioms and stereotypes. Otherwise, for designing usable interfaces, just stick to what people know and understand. It'll just make their lives a lot easier. Get the next slide. Something that you need to understand, of course, is that people have cultural associations, and you need to take the time to figure out whether your users actually have this, are making the same cultural associations that you're making. So early on, Sun Microsystems built one of the first email clients, and they had this mailbox that would kind of flip the little flag up if the person had mail. But they found it, the interface and the icon, to actually have absolutely no meaning for people that lived in urban areas and didn't have these mailboxes to use. And of course, next slide, Canada is moving to these mailboxes, which are sort of community mailboxes. And that's a little bit problematic too, right? So let's suppose you actually built your mail icon to look like this thing. Is anybody going to know what this thing is aside from those of us that have to use it in Canada, right? So next slide. That's basically idioms and population stereotypes. Essentially, the the guidance is use the idioms that people are familiar with or your users are familiar with, and only deviate from them if you are certain that there's a really good reason for doing it. Next slide. We're going to get into the notion of conceptual models, right? So people have mental or conceptual models of how things work, right? So sometimes you'll hear it as mental models, sometimes you'll hear it as conceptual models. And what do we construct these models from? So we construct these models from the affordances that we have, the affordances that the interface provides, causality, constraints, mapping, positive transfer, that is things that we've known in the past, population stereotypes or cultural standards, that is the things that we're familiar with kind of in our environment, perhaps instructions that we have, interactions that we have with other people. These things all contribute to our understanding of how things work, whether it be systems that are systems in terms of computer systems or just tools or objects, right? You know, our expectations contribute to these mental models. So next slide. If you think about what these models are, they might actually be wrong, particularly if our understanding of how a system should work or the attributes of that model are actually misleading or incorrect. What's really neat about conceptual models, though, is that models allow us to mentally simulate device operation. So if you think about what this means, they're essentially like, if I have a model of how a system works, it is essentially a theory about how the thing works. And so in my head, I can actually simulate what the system will actually do based on that theory, right? And if you think really hard about this, often you're not really sure if your mental model is perfect, particularly when you're using a new system, right? A new tool, whatever it might be. But nevertheless, you have some conceptual model, even if it's not perfect. The interesting thing is, as a designer, you actually don't have control over a user's mental model. All you have control over is the system image. That is the shell of the system that you are building, right? What it projects to the outside world. This is the image that it is giving to other people, right? So let's take a peek at the next slide here. If we take a look at this, this is called the conference bike. This is actually a bike that exists. You can rent it. I think in Canada or Calgary, you can rent it somewhere. People often use it as a team building device. What's really interesting thing is that our conceptual model of how this bike actually works is probably not very good, right? You're kind of looking at the gears and that sort of stuff, and you're like, I'm not really sure how that's going to all work. But the thing is that it's good enough to recognize that this is actually a bike. So we can actually see that this bike, this conference bike, is actually a bike. And this is because it has certain elements that kind of hint that it's a bike, right? It's got, you know, these wheels, it's got seats, it's got pedals. You can see that it's got some sort of steering wheel thing going on at the top. So that's not kind of something that we see on bikes. But there are enough features here that kind of hint that there is that this is a bike. And that is our conceptual model, right? And so if you think about what that conceptual model is doing, that conceptual model is giving you a mechanism that allows you to sort of simulate how this thing is actually going to work, right? So you've probably never seen this thing. Or if you have, great, but too bad. So this example is not going to work for you. But if you haven't, you can kind of imagine. You can kind of imagine people sitting on this bike, kind of like talking to each other, you know, holding the handle together, like biking, and somehow that's propelling the bike in the same direction, right? So this is, you're simulating. This mental model is helping you to simulate how you imagine this thing to be used. So take a look at the next slide. We have conceptual models of simple machines, right? And these are, as I said, informed by some of these concepts that we already have now, right? So here's a pair of scissors. You know, how does this work, right? Well, it affords holding, right? So the holds indicate that something needs to be inserted, i.e. your fingers. Some constraints, big hole for several fingers, small hole for just one finger or your thumb, right? There are some mappings, right? Holes for fingers are suggested or constrained by the appearance and how it's shaped. There's some positive transfer, obviously. You learn this stuff when you were a baby, right? When you were, not a baby, hopefully, but, you know, when you were in kindergarten. And it's a constant mechanism. This thing that looks like this, it hasn't changed over time, right? So because it's a physical object, it implies how the operating parts work, right? So a reasonable conceptual model can be formed just by looking at or perhaps holding this object. You don't need to understand everything, but some things do go away. Why does the big blade actually point down? The model's not perfect, right? It doesn't kind of teach you that you can use this to glide cut certain objects, right? But it's sufficient for many of our needs. So let's move on to a slightly more complex device, right? Slightly more. Let's move to the next slide here. So here's a faucet, and the way the faucet works is it's one of these that you put your hands underneath and it just kind of goes, right? So let's talk about it in terms of these concepts that we now have. Well, it affords putting your hands under because there's a space that you can put your hand under. But the problem with these devices when you use them is that they often stop before you're done. So how do you actually continue, right? There are some constraints, and the mapping is not very clear. How do you control the actual temperature? And often with these things, you actually can't. How can you perhaps control the flow rate of these things? Typically, you can't, right? Transfer, is there meaningful transfer from manual faucets? My argument is not really, except for that we understand that water is going to come out, but it doesn't kind of tell us how we can control this thing. And I would say that in this case, the conceptual model must be taught or learned, because it varies between models. And often when you go into these situations where they have these devices, there's signs that say, put your hands underneath the faucet to turn on the flow of water, right? Again, remember, signs, if they are there, tell you that what is happening is insufficient to provide people with sufficient clues about how to use the system. So you can obviously think about how this relates to interacting with more complex computational devices, right? So think about when you download this new app and you're not really sure exactly how to use it or what it does, right? So how do you develop this conceptual model of this thing, right? So your computer, your mobile phone, perhaps even a watch, right? So let's take a look at what a watch looks like. Here's the next slide. So here's a very simple digital watch, right? Affordances. There are four buttons to push, but it's not clear what they will do necessarily. Some constraints. There's no visible relation between the buttons or the possible actions and the end result. There's little relation between this and analog watches. Or another way to think about it is there's little relation between this device and our phones, which many of us use to keep time now, right? It turns out that across most of these watches, there is some standard core controls, but there's still some variation, right? So again, here is a conceptual model that actually must be taught. Or when I say taught, it's something that perhaps somebody can experiment it with and figure out over time. But it's not something that's perfectly clear right off the top. All right. So next slide. A conceptual model, this is what Don Norman has to say about these. In interacting with the environment, with others, and with artifacts of technology, people form internal mental models of themselves and the things with which they are interacting. These models provide predictive and explanatory power for understanding the interaction. So here's what he's saying, right? He's talking about kind of where these mental models are coming from. Well, they come from interacting with things. They come from interacting with others, right? Like I have to learn from somebody else. They come from also interacting with the environment. That is, they come from all of my previous experiences with everything else. And so when I come up with this mental model, I can use it for predictive power. That is, I can simulate interaction in my head, right? And the other thing is, these mental models often provide an explanatory power, so that I can actually explain why something happened, right? So it's kind of like this reverse thing that's going on. So if we hit the next slide, what is the relationship between conceptual model and conceptual design? Well, conceptual model is something that the user has, or forms, or they develop, right? This is their understanding of how the system actually works. And in fact, people rely on this understanding as they use the system that you have for them, as they use the system that you've given to them. They're relying on their understanding of how the system might work. Now, conceptual design is something that you do as a designer, right? So you're trying to define an intended mental model. So you're trying to perhaps hide certain aspects of the technology, right? They don't need to know this part, right? And so what you are trying to do in conceptual design is you are trying to design a suitable system image, right? This is what the user actually sees, so that a user can develop an effective and reasonable mental model of how the system is supposed to work, right? So conceptual design is something that you do as a designer. You are building the system image, or what it is that the person sees of the system, or how the person sees the system. But ultimately, that's the best you got. There's no real dialogue. You can't keep talking to them, right? They're just going to develop the mental model that they do. All right, so next slide. So here is a quick image that illustrates what's going on here, right? So I want you to take a look at this, right? So there's a user, there's a designer, there's a system model, right? And there's also a system image. And in fact, often I actually get rid of the system model piece of this. But you can see that the user's model is kind of up in the top right. It just belongs to the user. And the only way that you as a designer can communicate that design model, or how you understand how the system should be done, is through that system image, or what is revealed in the system, right? And then there's a two-way interaction between the system image and the user, because there's a dialogue between those two things. Right? A user uses the system over time, and that actually ultimately affects the user's model, right? So they may come in with a preconceived notion, and that affects how they see the system image, right? But as they use it, they may learn things, and that in turn affects the user model over time. Okay? So next slide, some models. So here's just some terms. These are the ones that I really care about. Design model, what the user intends to convey. A system image, what the user actually sees, the UI, the documentation, the labels, and so forth. The user's model, or conceptual model, or mental model. The user's mental model developed by the user through interaction with the system. And part of it may actually come from before. So, i.e., it is a belief system about how the system actually works. Right? That's what a mental model is. So, you should have the learning objectives down now. Thanks, and we'll continue talking next time.